We do important shit ourselves.
It's not like Elon started saying provocative things on X just this past year.
He's been openly critical of Kamala Harris. He's been very supportive of Trump. Our outbound lot's broken. Our inbound lot is broken. How am I supposed to lose without a computer?
Compared to the 5-year and 10-year plan of the Chinese government, it is a small down payment on what is necessary.
When I saw the president of the United States, still to this day, has left a very lasting pain.
In the end, the product is the thing that actually matters.
You're a very accomplished guy, okay? So you worked with President Obama. You were his energy advisor. You were a VP at Tesla, right? So my question is, why are you hanging out with us, two bozos? What the hell?
Well, you called Hans a nerd. I've now become a nerd of folks like yourself. You know, I'm just as much of a fan as I became a fan. I didn't join Tesla as a fan. I didn't join Tesla as a direct sales and service warrior. Didn't think I'd get into the Cybertruck as much as I have. Didn't think I'd, you know, care that much about autonomous vehicle policy. Now, I came in as a climate nerd and a clean energy person and left as a Tesla fan. So that's why.
I love that. And then how long were you a Tesla for those that are not familiar?
7.5 years.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you joined in 2016-ish, I guess, would have been the year?
Yep. Yeah. End of 2016.
So this was right at the beginning of the Model 3 ramp, when everybody was kind of doubting the company's ability to execute on such a grand vision, perhaps doubting their ambitions around building a gigafactory in Nevada. Talk, like, what was that like? You know, because I've shared stories from my end. I mean, we both, you know, we overlapped for 4 years, but we weren't on the same org. We were on sort of two different planets. And what's funny is that I met you after I left Tesla, which is the most hilarious part. Like, I'm meeting a lot of people after I leave Tesla because it's such a gigantic org. But what was that time like? Because, man, like, every time I talk to people that have been at the company, there's so many like insane stories of survival, like through a very brutal time of getting the company to scale. Walk me through what your experience was like as much as you can.
We need a lot more than an hour and a half for that. You know, it's I think the people that came before me at Tesla and are still there or have been hired since are just remarkable, just absolutely remarkable. And a lot of times what ends up happening is people sort of, we tend to forget all of the blood, sweat and tears that goes into developing a startup, figuring things out in the beginning. You know, how to get the right signage for a factory, to, you know, which partners to choose and which not to choose, what chemicals to use, battery size to use, you know, lots and lots of different decisions. I'll just give you an anecdote from my very first day. I get on a conference call. I had taken the desk of a guy named Mateo Jaramillo, who's since founded Forum Energy, which, by the way, you guys should do a whole podcast just about the Tesla diaspora. Maybe you have. Unbelievable. Like, it's crazy. The number of founded companies from ex-Tesla people and the success they're having. I'm at his desk in DC. I jump on this phone call, didn't even have a computer, at the time. Didn't have my login information, and JB is speaking on the phone call about, I won't get into the specifics of all the partnerships and everything, but basically that there was some chemical that, didn't have all the EPA testing and approval that had needed to get done. And he says on the call, I literally first day, Elon hired some effing somebody, and I don't know what the hell he's doing. Doesn't seem like he's doing a damn thing. Let me find it. Rohan. And so he didn't know that anyone was on a call. He didn't know there was a call. He thought it was just a meeting, but somebody had dialed into this thing. So I said, JB, hey, it's Rohan, first day here. and off to the races from there. But you know what, one of the things he said on that call, and it stuck with me, throughout, and it's kind of a Tesla ethos, as far as I do know this now. And Hans, I think you guys understand this very well. I remember him saying this, like it was yesterday. Who in the hell decided to partner with X company? We do important shit ourselves.
Yeah.
If it's important, we should be doing it. Oh, why did you guys decide to do this testing regime with some godforsaken partner? And a lot of that was born out of a fear that people were coming after Tesla, or that incumbents in the industry, various industries, were not on the up and up, potentially trying to undermine Tesla, might look to infiltrate the supply chain in some form. That a derogatory term, but I think it's actually a compliment. That paranoia really served Tesla very, very, very well, and helped develop that ethos of, we're going to do this shit ourselves. We're going to figure this stuff out. So that was my very first day. And, you know, JB, since then, what a gentleman, what a really wonderful guy. But just goes to show you how hardcore, every little thing was, and how, unbelievably focused the team was in getting things right. The time they were not so right.
Yeah. That's such an awesome story. I mean, as you're talking through that, I get all these flashbacks of these moments in time of me. I mean, my first day sort of story is very similar. I show up at the, I was on the supply chain side at the warehouse side. So we had this rink-a-dink 132,000 square foot facility in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And it was brought on, you know, as a analyst by title. But, you know, when I was interviewing, they're like, you know, we're going to need your help in a lot of stuff. You know, I had a director background previously at a distribution company. I'm like, yeah, whatever. A huge fan of the company. I had a Model S at the time. I'm like, I'm going to come in and kick ass because I'm passionate about this company. I want to get stuff done. Okay. I walk in, computer doesn't work. My login didn't work for like 2 days. Right. So I brought an extra computer, having heard stories that, hey, your login might not work. And then once I bring my computer, I'm like, okay, well, this is probably going to be useless, but whatever. I'll bring it in just to show that I'm freaking motivated and I'm ready to go. So I walk in and, you know, I meet my manager, and my manager is like, hey, you know, nice to see you again, Farzad. You know, if you don't remember me, I'm Greg. Nice to meet you. Greg German, still a very good friend of mine. He's just a killer. One of the most talented people I've truly ever met. And he's like, okay, cool. Let's do a 5-minute tour real quick. Okay, great. All right. So, our outbound lot's broken. Our inbound lot is broken. Our inventory control is terrible. We can't get product out fast enough. We have a 10-day backlog. How can you help us? And I'm like, what the f? How am I supposed to do this without a computer? You know? But then that first day was from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. You know, I was just taking everything in. And then I went home. I remember going home and I'm like, to my wife, I'm like, I don't understand how this company is like afloat. You know, because there's just so much chaos and everything feels so urgent. It feels like everything was like put together with like band-aids, and we were given rocks and sticks to make a spaceship. But I think that sort of formula is the magic behind Tesla, because it forced you to figure out how to do a lot with a little. And the biggest thing that I learned was, if you're a magnet for top tier talent and you give them that environment and you give them the keys, they will figure it out, right? Does that resonate with you at all? Because that was my biggest takeaway from my experience there. I don't know if that resonates with you at all. I'm sure it does in some.
Yeah. If it definitely does. I mean, like fast forward a week, 1 week after that, I'm being picked up in Nevada by one of the people at the Gigafactory, who ended up working my team later. And he's like, where are you staying? The La Quinta. It's like, well, wait, why are you staying at the La Quinta? I said, well, I don't know. Like, my boss at the time said, we stay at places that your door should be going to the outside. It should not be inside of a hotel, yeah. Basically a motel. So I'm staying at the La Quinta. The next day, we drive over to Fremont and we're washing cars. And it just, you know, it just goes to show you, right? Like, to your point, you're pretty much trying everything, doing anything, figuring out everything. And once you show some level of accomplishment, the sky's the limit. Then all of a sudden, and sometimes this can get a company in trouble, and it got me in trouble at times too. It's like, oh, you may have done a good job over here. Let's try to see if that translates, see if we can put you in crazy positions, see if we can ask you to do more than maybe what your background suggests you could do. So yeah, anyways, that definitely was the case for me too.
It seems like such an interesting case study for how to run startup cultures at scale. You know, I think you and I talked about this very briefly when we met last, but it's like the one thing that I've taken away is, you know, when I look around at other businesses or I look around, you know, just any entity, right? And I'm like, and I take the time that I had at Tesla and I'm like, okay, if a company that's 100,000 people plus can operate like this, what is the limiting factor from every other company or every other company of that size operating like that, right? And so in my head, it's like, it's got to be culture. It has to be some sort of leader that's up front, that's, you know, leading the charge and saying, this is how we're going to do it, right? But like, how do you, what do you think that formula is? Like, you know, I think I remember your answer from last time, but I would love to sort of hear your take, you know, so the audience can hear it too, because I think that is like so profound, and it would make the world such a better place if every industry borrowed a lot of that type of sort of execution. Like if we look at what Elon did with X as an example, right? 80% less people, the platform still works, right? SpaceX is way leaner than Boeing, and they're doing a lot more than Boeing, especially in relation to the NASA sort of partnerships that they had, right? Tesla versus other EV makers, you know, outside of the Chinese players who are super competitive, there is like there's that secret sauce. Can you maybe help verbalize that? Like, what do you think that is?
You know, there's a lot of reasons why Elon is amazing, a lot. But I think organizationally that it's probably more the case than anywhere else. And part of that is because he has the ability to take in lots of different types of information across lots of different inputs and sectors and synthesize it in a way that I don't think many people can do. But I think the thing that's incredibly important is taking the engineering side and transferring that into other places as well. Getting rid of the parts that don't make any sense and simplifying and simplifying and simplifying until you've simplified too much, cutting until you've cut too much. Those are things that he takes to lots of different business thought processes, not just engineering a car or engineering a rocket ship. And that I think that mindset is really important because all too often we're building, and that's his first principle mindset. Like, this is nothing, you know, new for any of your listeners, but that taking that mindset to all different types of things, including government issues and policy issues, and being willing to dive super deep with people in the government that actually understand these things, or in the site selection process, or in a business development partnership, to dive all the way down to the very bottom rung of the building block and then building back up. But I think the other piece is putting crazy amounts of pressure, good pressure, I think fun pressure, on every single team. You know, at the time, if you ask me, was it fun pressure? You know, sometimes, you know, getting the nasty grams, you know, at late hours of the night, not always the most fun, but, looking back at it, I think we can laugh about it and have fun with
only the survivors call it fun pressure.
but it was pressurizing every single part of the process. Don't be the laggard. Don't be the limiting factor. And so, you know, that piece, speed is everything, but speed is everything only once you've gotten all the barnacles off, you've gotten all the dumb processes off, you've gotten all the stupid inputs out, then you can speed, get to speed. And that's true for everything, not just making products.
The one thing that you were talking about there that's interesting to also, you know, it's like the sounding board, because, you know, one of the theories is like that type of approach can be transferable to a lot of different places, right? Just delete and then go fast. But it takes a certain level of pain tolerance to be willing to sift through that pain, you know, as you're deleting things. Because when you're, you probably know this more than anybody else in probably, you know, there's maybe 10 people at Tesla that might know this as well as you do. But just removing that pain, or removing all those things so that you can highlight the loudest pain point, and then you fix the loudest pain point, right? And that becomes your sort of your priority list of things to hit. Hunt, I don't want to hog. I could literally talk to Rohan for like 10 hours. So I want to make sure you can, we have a lot of topics to hit too. So go for it.
Yeah. I remember that Andre Karpathy in one of his interviews said that, you know, Elon is an incredibly effective warrior in the fight against entropy. And I think he was talking about specifically in the context of organizations. And so, yeah, I mean, you've kind of touched on that topic. I'm just curious to hear your interpretation of what Andre means by that, if there's anything more to say that you haven't already said here in the last couple of minutes.
Well, I think one thing that's really important to note is you have to be inspiring, and you have to be able to get other people to follow you. You know, it's not enough to just be able to say these things and, you know, throw it up on a podcast. And, you know, he had followers. He had people that really gave a shit and believed in it hardcore. It didn't really matter whether he said it in a nice way or in a not so nice way. They themselves believed in it, ultimately just as much, or sometimes even more than he did. So that's why it works, is because you've found others that fundamentally believe in the same, principles that you do. And ones that don't, get them the hell out of there, you know, and get them out quick.
That's actually a really interesting observation, because, you know, what you were talking about was there's a requirement for a certain pain threshold, like that the organization has to have as a whole in order to find those limitations, like in order to find those bottlenecks,
yeah,
in order to, you know, be willing and courageous enough to suffer through the fun pressure that you experience when you're building up a project from zero. And like, you can't do that unless you have, like, the only people who are capable of having that sort of pain threshold at an organizational level are true believers. And so, like, you can't build an organization like that if the organization itself is not one that attracts a high percentage of true believers.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to your point, Hans, like, this is so true. You know, our Gigafactory Berlin site selection process was a whole thing unto itself, right? And some of it's public, some of it's not, but the larger point was, like, Berlin is a place before we located our Gigafactory there that was quite well known for a airport just down the road. It took 15 years or some wild number of years. I should know this now, given how many times I've heard it. Wild number of years to be operational. And the permitting problems in Europe generally, but also specific to Germany and specific to that particular region, were incredibly well understood. Now, you might think, oh, this was some great negotiating tactic by me or somebody on my team, or, you know, someone else on our permitting team, engineering team. Honestly, this is about pain threshold. It's about your ability to say, everyone who has built a factory in Europe, but especially in Germany, has said it'll take 4, 5, 6 years. Maybe if you're really fast, you can get it done a little bit sooner than that. And we said, well, we want to understand at its core, what the hell are the exact laws? We're not willing to say, oh, let me call up this consultant, and this is what the consultant says to do, and here's what the land use attorney says, and here's what the civil engineering firm says. No, we want to read the actual law, regulation, and any municipal code that might affect how we would decide how to permit this project and whether or not we could go faster. And so there's a process that the short form is, it's called the 8A permitting regime in Berlin at Gigafactory Berlin. And they're still using it, unfortunately, because there hasn't been a better process that, but nobody else had done that because the pain threshold for potentially messing up and having to redo the entire building or part of a building was too much for any organization to absorb. That was something we were happy to go right into. So there's lots of those kinds of examples. And without those types of examples, you can't have speed and a willingness to, you know, get written about how did they avoid some environmental thing? Did you avoid some labor thing? Did you avoid some other law? No, we didn't. We were crazy good at adhering to every little thing. People just assumed because we were fast that we must have been evading some oversight in some form. That was not the case.
Yeah. That's why I like to tell, you know, people when they ask me, is like, I feel like Tesla's just a magnet for psychos. So is SpaceX. It's just a magnet for psychos. Like, I don't know how else best to explain that, you know? And I mean that obviously in a very flattering way, because, you know, I got to pat myself on the back a little bit there. But that pain thing, that was such a huge lesson. It's, you know, I feel like there's just so many different lessons that I took away from my experience at that company. And I'm sure people that worked at SpaceX and other Musk companies, they can probably take away a lot of those lessons too, is like, it really is a question of will and a question of just getting down to the dirty stuff that very few people are willing to get into and shedding your ego, right? That was another huge one too, that it was a piece of advice that was given to me before I joined, is like, I asked, what is the biggest piece of advice you can give me? And I thought it was like, you know, work your hardest, you know, like, yeah, like make sure you're creating good network, blah, blah, blah. The standard boilerplate. I got, do not come in with an ego. Put your ego aside, because the stuff you're going to face is going to be brutal. And they're going to trust you with that brutal stuff. And it's on you to fix it, right? Yeah, man, it's so fun just thinking back to, and we could literally spend an hour and a half talking just specifically about that. So tell me a little bit on, so one of the things that we discussed briefly on X was the EV tax credit. I want to talk about that a little bit. What are some of the misunderstandings that are out there about the EV tax credit in relation to Tesla and other EV makers and hybrids that maybe you want to talk about? There was a post you made on X where you were calling out myself and whole Mars blog on the interpretation of the EV tax credit today and how it applies to hybrids versus EVs. So
lovingly, platform, lovingly, okay. Lovingly,
of course, bro. Of course. Yeah. Come on. Somebody as beautiful as you, of course. No, but I really want to hear your perspective, because obviously you were extremely close in that process. This is your wheelhouse. So yeah, the floor is yours. What are the things that you want to discuss from that perspective?
So there's a few things, like, and I won't over torque on this particular policy, because there's a lot of others that are even more important and that we're focused on much more. But rewind 2000 Energy Policy Act, Orrin Hatch, and then Senator Barack Obama were, and amongst others, were working on policies like this one. 30D gets written. Bush signs it into law, gets re-upped a couple of times. But the policy at the time, and in part to get people on board, was one that had a cap, 17 kilowatt hours on the battery, or I should say a threshold. Once you hit that, you could get the maximum $7,500. And that translated, I think it was 17.2 or 17.4, whatever the exact number was for the Chevy Volt, so that the Volt could get the full EV tax credit at the time. That's the reason for that policy. But it had a maximum of 200,000. Now, you know, Tesla made sure that we hit the 200,000 right at the beginning of the quarter, so we got the full next couple of quarters after that. So, but, you know, it was a significant issue. for, you know, a growing company, one that was still losing a lot of cash. So Tesla didn't have access to that credit, starting, you know, at the beginning of the Trump administration, basically. And GM about a year later also lost the credit, something, well, maybe a little bit longer than that. I'm going to get my dates slightly wrong. So no access to the credit, but everyone else, anyone that was selling an EV, whether they had critical minerals coming straight from China, the battery could be coming straight from China or Iran or North Korea. No, you know, it didn't matter. They were getting that $7,500. So Tesla was at a $7,500 disadvantage. So part of what I had been pushing, and I think the company had been pushing, was either just put us on a level playing field. Everybody's at zero. Get a credit that at least American companies, ones that are making the credit, making the battery in the United States of America, or making the car in the United States of America, have an advantage if you care about American manufacturing. Trump killed two bills, both bills that were written by Republicans, authored by Republicans, killed them both, basically said, we're not going to be supporting EVs. And that was in the end game. This was not like some nascent bill that never had a shot. No, this was in the end game of tax policy that could have gotten done. Fast forward, we have the Build Back Better, which was the sort of Biden plan for what ended up becoming the Inflation Reduction Act. It was, had a lot of things that ended up in the IRA, but some critical things that were not in there. The EV tax credit was in there, but it also included, they proposed like this union adder. To be clear, that union adder really never had much of a shot. Likely would have been considered illegal, by the parliamentarian, which many of us that understood this already kind of knew, but leave that aside. The EV tax credit passes. So the same basic thresholds exist from 2006 till today, which is that, yes, a plug-in hybrid can qualify for the maximum. But today, everyone is at, there's no 200,000 cap, and there's requirements about battery sourcing, component sourcing, and where you actually produce the vehicle itself. So these are things that I think are really quite valuable to have in term. Now, is the policy perfect? I mean, Farzad, my own team is like, I cannot believe that you're on X doing battle with Farzad and whole Mars blog on, I hate PHEVs. I think PHEVs are dumb. I don't mind them as a, like as a bridge. I don't begrudge any company making them well or making them efficiently at all. No problem. But what has been the problem has been that in general, in policy circles, especially, and in the way that the ZEV program works or the GHG program work, these credit trading programs work, we are valuing the emissions reduction from PHEVs way too much. That has been the case. I've been fighting for that basically my entire career. So I am no fan of PHEVs, certainly in the policy area. PHEVs,
for those that are not familiar, hybrids.
Plug-in hybrids. Not general hybrids. Plug-in hybrids that you actually can plug in. Yeah. I mean, general hybrids, that's not a thing anymore. So that's kind of like the... And so part of the criticism of the IRA, and especially of this particular credit, has been, oh, you're just helping plug-in hybrids. But the... facts tell a different story. The number of PHEVs getting the consumer credit, consumer purchase incentive, very low. Even on the leasing, if you add everyone up, I mean, Tesla is by far the biggest beneficiary of the IRA on the purchase incentive. And then you add in all of the battery materials, which has a 10% ITC. You add in the battery credit itself, which is a 45 kilowatt hour benefit. So you've got tons of benefits from the IRA, even outside of the consumer credit, that are benefiting BEVs, the likes of which Tesla is making. So the thing that I was getting annoyed by, and I probably shouldn't have taken it too defensively. It was kind of stupid on my part. But the thing I was getting annoyed by is
it's good content.
It's like, what am I seeing here from people that are otherwise incredibly smart? why are we getting so excited about these PHEVs that are barely getting, you know, this is not a thing. This is not a thing we should be worried about. Big picture, this is not a thing we should be worried about. We should be worried about, and the European Commission has taken this on, thankfully. I think we played a role here. The California Air Resources Board taking on PHEVs in a way that's useful. Basically cutting out any PHEVs that don't have, that are 50 miles of range and less, which cuts out quite a few, actually. I thought they should have gone higher to 80 or 90. But this is the kind of stuff that's happening. I think slowly but surely these policies are getting put in place.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So let me kind of walk you through maybe a little bit more nuanced. So everything you said makes perfect sense. And I agree with the sentiment that you've put forward. I think from where I come from is, I think any sort of incentive to an automaker. So if you look at it outside of the Tesla sphere, you have legacy automakers in the United States that are trying to transition, or, you know, one would hope they're trying to transition to the next generation transportation system, because that's where we're going from a cost perspective, from a reliability perspective, from a usability perspective, technology perspective, everything's saying you have to go here, right? And that traditionally speaking, we've seen legacy automakers trying to do that, but doing so very unsuccessfully. They are able to make electric vehicles, but very few of them seem to be able to make it at a profit. And so I think it's just one hybrid, plug-in hybrid in the United States that you pointed out that is actually eligible for the full tax credit. I think the Pacifica van is the one. I forget which one it is.
Made in Canada.
So even if it's one car, the incentive is there from my viewpoint for an automaker to be incentivized to make plug-in hybrids, which still are transportation systems that carry an internal combustion engine, right? Versus being fully incentivized to move to electric. So the way I view it is that even though there is a threshold to meet to get the full tax credit, I don't even know why that threshold exists in the first place for anything that carries gasoline, right? And if I view like the overall, you know, and this is, again, if I apply I know how Tesla can operate, and I'm applying that lens to every other organization, I'm pulling my hair out. I'm like, why is, even if it's a very small percentage of my tax dollars, why is that going to fund that when it's not fully incentivizing the other thing, which is to go full EV, right?
But that's not an argument that you're having with me. Because I agree with that.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to get more nuance behind it. Like this is why I end up in that place. Because of that dynamic. Yeah.
That's a political economy question completely, right? Do you want everything? I mean, I do, but you're not gonna get everything. Yeah. So do you want the whole thing and you're never actually gonna be able to eat the full cake? Or do you want 3/4 of the cake? And yeah, you get a little bit of shit sandwich in there too.
You've seen it. Like that.
That's
belly.
The, yeah, yeah. This is the problem, generally with policy and politics globally. That's hard. In order to get big things done. And this bill, it's not just the, Inflation Reduction Act, but it's unbelievable what it's doing. It's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, remaking, the economy and pushing incentives to actually build stuff. It's basically saying, you know what? Here's what Tesla was doing. Not only are we going to help Tesla put their stuff on steroids with emphasizing American manufacturing in critical places, all of these other companies, especially the South Koreans and the Japanese, are also incentivized, including some American companies and nascent companies and startups, to be in this realm as well. And you see the amount of stuff happening. I mean, I was just in New York City meeting with all sorts of startups and some companies and former supply chain partners of Tesla and others. I mean, it's really pretty wild. So that, I think that legacy is unbelievable from what the Inflation Reduction Act will end up seeing. So part of my worry, to be honest, Farzad, is more about the politics of needing this again. So the truth about the Inflation Reduction Act is that it is so game changing. And yet, compared to the 5-year and 10-year plan of the Chinese government, it is a small down payment on what is necessary. It's really well worth a read. The Chinese 2015 plan on this very set of issues that you guys cover is unbelievably prescient. And what they ended up doing was almost exactly what they said they would do, may actually even better than what they said they were going to do. That's the kind of thing. Now, we don't need to repeat the same mistakes they made. We don't need to do the exact thing. We don't need to support the same technologies. But if you're a U.S. sort of, if you're thinking about this from a U.S. and allies perspective, there's just no doubt we cannot afford, I don't think, from a national security perspective or an economic security perspective, to just cede this entire set of industries to China and Chinese adjacent entities. Like, that doesn't work. And I think that's why what I worry about when you're an incredibly, you know, well-spoken, awesome advocate for a lot of different cool things, and you're just fun, right? So people follow you. It's like, well, yes, the PHEV thing sucks. I don't even want to defend them anymore. I can't believe I was even half-heartedly defending that. That whole thing gets in the way of what I think is a much bigger picture.
It's a Trojan horse of sorts.
Issue. Yeah.
Go ahead, Hans.
The question that I have on this is, you know, from your position inside of supply chains and movers and shakers in government and industry, I saw a chart that blew my mind today. And it showed that, I think it was in 2016 or 2018, somewhere in the late teens, there were 50,000 startups in China in a single year. And that in 2023, there were 1,000. And that this was really due to the tech crackdown of Xi. And what I'm wondering is, you know, we've seen this massive acceleration in, you know, China's accomplishing their goals that they set strategically as a country. But I think that the engine of that accomplishment has been those startups, and that they really unleashed the forces of free markets and entrepreneurial endeavors. And it seems like they have kind of cut the, basically that drive and that, that engine off at the root here recently. And so, I mean, do you have a perspective on that? Will they be able to continue executing on their goals long term, or is this the beginning of a whole new secular shift in China?
No, it's not. I don't think so. I mean, I'm not the right person to be, giving you a whole, you know, sort of China lecture, but, I think it's a remarkable place and not to be underestimated at all in any way. No matter what people think about a real estate bubble, no matter what people think about a problematic set of policies on startups and that entire incentive structure in China, whatever they may think about the geopolitics of that China-Russia dynamic, all of the industrial policy throughout the globe, it is a remarkable place with remarkable people, and it will continue to be that. Now, I think Chinese companies that I know very, very well will tell you when they don't think they're being listened to at all. They themselves are quite worried about the dynamic you just mentioned, and especially worried about the way that investment, you know, it's critical that any country has a reinvigoration of investment and reinvigoration through startups. And they're quite worried about the policies that Xi has had, but also the perception of the policies that he has. So yeah, I think but look, we can get hypercritical about China. The truth is we've got to look at ourselves. We have to look at, 100%. What's happening in Europe. You know, we got a lot of things that we've got to fix. And frankly, I think we should be looking to the Chinese as a source of inspiration rather than criticism.
We had a guest on a couple weeks ago, or actually a couple months ago. Hans, what was the name of the gentleman? I'm blanking on his name.
Michael Dunn.
So
he's good. He's good.
My God, that podcast was such an eye-opening reinforcement of some of the things that we've been trying to bang the table on, which is, hey, we have an entire country that is looking to supplant our entire transportation system. they're basically trying to come out with the products that will be the things that are going to move us from point A to point B, and is going to render the entire supply chain obsolete in a long enough time scale if the United States is going up in this trend, which is like kind of like this, and China is like whoop, right? So let me
build off. Yeah, go ahead with your question, because I'm excited to get into the subject.
I mean, yeah. So why is this such a hard thing to get started? I mean, it shouldn't be like, it should have bipartisan support, right? You know, we want America to lead the world in next generation transportation systems, and then you can clearly see what's happening in China. Like, help me understand that. I'm much more curious about where you're taking us here. So yeah.
Well, so yeah, there's a couple things happening there. The all of the things that made me so excited to work at Tesla in the beginning, came to fruition around fighting industries that were holding back the transition to sustainable fuels, to sustainable energy. And so there's a utility sector that's a problem. There's, of course, the oil and gas sector that's a problem. There's legacy auto and legacy transportation companies that are a problem, a big problem. Now, when you combine all of those things, you've got a lot of different entities saying, hold on. And to the detriment of the national security, economic security of the country, not just here, really in any place that had significant investment in old school technologies and had too much of an old garden around those technologies. So China, while it did have an auto sector, of course, and while it did have a set of fossil industry and, you know, the utility, we have regulated monopolies here for the most part in the US, the utility sector, basically the government just saying, and in today is just one dude saying what he wants. So it's a different setup. And so you ask, well, why can't we just do this a little faster? That's really the core reason. We're a democracy. Sometimes that democracy can get eaten up by vested interests that have a lot of power. And you got to shake that up. And what Elon, Tesla, SpaceX, and other companies similarly positioned are doing is just that. Fighting back, but with products that make real sense and that people want anyways, because they're better. They're not better because they're, you know, greener. They're better because they're just better. They look cooler. They're faster. They're higher performance. That he did also in China. So this dynamic is another place where I was really lucky to both learn and get a chance to affect. So, you know, if you rewind, now this is a public thing, so it's not like I'm, you know, giving away any insider stuff, but like, you rewind 5 years, Elon at the time said to me, there's no chance that Europe's auto industry is going to be able to survive unless they take drastic action. And that means policy action. And he was seeing this as well in the US context. So none of us, you know, he didn't know exactly how that might play out and what that might mean. Would it be a border adjustment in terms of carbon? Would it be a tariffs regime? Would it be a whole range of subsidies? Some combo of all of these things, you know, nobody really knew, but planning a company around the first principles of global trade and seeing how things might go. Part of the reason for that was because he could see directly the buildup in China of all of these industries, the buildup of very technically capable entities, some of which were copying Tesla. Frankly, he didn't even mind that. So they were copying Tesla. They were copying some of the ideas and basic structures. That has really helped Tesla have a significant advantage, probably, I don't know SpaceX very well, but probably SpaceX as well, with supply chains that are way more regionalized, way stronger, way better understood. I'll give you an example. This is going to sound, I think to me, it was crazy. I go out to Indonesia on a trip and we're meeting with a whole bunch of different partners. Tesla is one of the very few companies, this is inclusive of Microsoft, Apple, anyone, that procures from the mine itself. Now, not everything, but a lot of important things. So the supply chain understanding, as far as that, I'm telling you things you already know, but maybe your audience doesn't quite know all of these things.
Oh, they're going to eat this up.
There's a fulsome understanding to the point where the US government was bringing us in on a weekly basis, seemingly, with supply chain partners across the board to try to understand how these dynamics were playing out. But because we knew exactly what was happening at the mine, not only that did that help us from an environmental or a labor perspective or any other perspective that we might want to look at, or we might want to have supply chain integrity and responsibility around. I think we were better at that than companies that put up all this crazy ESG stuff and put up lots of glossy stuff about how great they are. I mean, because we actually knew the steps in every single. Now, rewind. Why does Tesla have? It's not because there's some control issue and some, you know, weird thing about wanting to have verticalization for verticalization's sake. That's not the case. In fact, what the reason was a paranoia that we might get screwed over by players that were much bigger than us, had a vested interest in killing us. And so we wanted to understand exactly where every single thing was coming from so that somebody could not squeeze us by the neck and kill us. That's the reason. So we knew every little thing. I'm in Indonesia, and I always, whenever I went into any foreign country, I would usually call the ambassador to the country or somebody at the embassy and sit down and just say, hey, we're here. Usually it was a waste of time, probably for them too, but definitely for me, it was usually a waste of time, but I felt like it was a nice thing to do. So I sit down in Indonesia with the State Department and the Commerce Department, and they tell me that I will be the first U.S. citizen ever to step foot in what is called Morowali. So I'm thinking, oh, well, okay, cool. Well, first guy ever and U.S. guy ever to show up here. So we take this flight out, looks like a pretty decent sized airport. Pass by one deep sea port, pass by a second deep sea port. We're staying at a 5-star hotel. There's multiple processing plants, a nascent cathode facility, a recycling facility, multiple mines, lots of people everywhere, all Chinese. Everything is owned by the Chinese for the most part. Some Indonesian co-ownership, but for the most part. It just goes to show you like the level of investment by the Chinese entities and the level of technology advancement. It wasn't just that they were being able to be subsidized. No, they were cheaper. They were half the cost of some of the Australian and Canadian players and Brazilian players that had been there forever. It was a wake up call for me on this question of how best to organize your industrial policy. It was a wake up call for me that like, man, where the hell is my government? Why aren't they doing anything here? And one very senior Indonesian official, I'll never forget him saying this, you know, I said, oh, are you working with Exim Bank? You're working with DFC? You're working with any of these, you know, these entities in the US? Yeah, we're working with them. We sit down with them. They're great. They have lots of critiques of our labor standards or environmental issues. It's like, oh, and what about the Chinese? Well, they show up, they've got a checkbook. And there's a big difference in terms of strategy. It doesn't mean that we should forsake our values on any of these items. We should not. We should care about these things a lot. We should care about how we treat workers a lot. We should care about the environment a lot. But it's crazy not to be in the game. And Tesla, to its credit, was in the game. And most of the rest of the European entities and others are not. One other country that I should call out, because I think, just in terms of innovation and products and robotics and AI, South Korea, they are really kind of a sight to behold in terms of the number of companies and the amount. And they're probably the biggest winner from the IRA, to be honest, outside of the US companies, is they were able to, because there's this anti-China sentiment, they were really able to come in, SK, LG, Samsung, Hanwha, Kyusa, all these companies come in, Hyundai, and really benefit.
Okay. So
sorry, long-winded.
No, that was incredible. Real quick heads up, the mic keeps hitting your zipper. You're getting, you got really excited, but it's good. It's perfect. No, I love it. I love it. Okay. So what I heard there, sort of the synopsis, is that the China is going all in. They're just going all in across the entire world to set up what they think they need to 10x, 100x this new transportation system. Hums, I see you went off mute. What did you want to add?
Yeah, I was going to phrase it. It sounds like what you're telling me is that our luxury beliefs are China's opportunity.
Okay. And then the other thing I heard too is that there's a party that is, in this case, China, that is willing to go through the pain required to do something like this, whereas the West, called United States and Europe, is being bogged down by bureaucracy, right? So, and I hate to be pessimistic, this sounds like game over.
No, not at all.
Okay.
That's exactly why the Inflation Reduction Act is so important, and it has stimulated so much conversation elsewhere in Chile, in South America, in Brazil, in Canada. Canada had to respond in a big way. They started really investing in cathode production, battery materials work. Europe also has had to respond and figure out how the hell they're going to have a bridge here, because they've got a ton of companies, especially in the auto sector, that look a little weak, more than a little weak. You know, you mentioned the guest that you had on. He's done a really good job in a very pithy way of like creating awareness of just how much capacity exists in China. Just, you know, it doesn't take a mathematician, but it's pretty simple. Where the hell is this stuff going? If there's not markets in the US and there's not a great market in Europe, stuff is going everywhere else, which means Toyota, watch out, Volkswagen, watch out, General Motors and Ford, to the extent they still have significant pieces and, you know, watch out. You know, your traditional players need to really be careful.
Yeah. So, okay. That gives me some encouragement. I think so then this is a question I have. Let's get to some of the spicy stuff. But so the IRA, I agree with you 1,000%. My personal favorite thing the Biden administration has put forward by far: incentivized manufacturing of next generation transportation systems. It's trying to localize a lot of the supply chain. It's one variable that is trying to move the United States and its allies a little bit more forward, nowhere near as much as it should have. And it has, you know, some pieces that I personally don't like, but, you know, we already went through that, right? So then help me understand, you know, so Elon, in this case, Elon, as we talked about, super close to the entire story. He, you know, as the person that goes into the smallest weeds that he can to find the solution, he knows exactly, he's probably as well versed as anybody else on this planet on how this thing is shaping up and how it's impacting his companies. And so help me understand his transition away from the party that has put this forward to the Republican Party and Trump. So, like, as somebody who obviously has experience, a lot of experience in government, a lot of experience at Tesla, has worked with Elon directly, paint a picture for me. Help me understand this a little bit better. Because, you know, my lens is X and the internet and what I'm trying to learn, and obviously some, you know, the information I'm trying to absorb. But I would love to hear your perspective on this. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is just one take. You know, it's hard to put yourself in the mind of somebody else on exactly what they made, you know, and there's lots of, you know, he's put some of this in posts and interviews. And I think, you know, I think some of that should speak for itself, but here's one take: is in part the core work that especially Tesla is doing is likely to be benefit on solar, on storage, on the combo of those things in virtual power plants, the power electronics work, the needed transmission, electric vehicles, battery materials. Generally speaking, Democrats want to support all of that anyways. So even if, let's say, his guy loses, he still gets a lot of good stuff anyways. Now, if on the other hand, he was like a, let's go Kamala, we really love Kamala. Well, on the other side, we got a dude talking about windmills causing cancer. He barely seems to understand what the hell's happening with battery storage in the country. Seems to think that EVs don't have enough range. Electric trucks are stupid. He can't figure out really anything in this general clean tech, clean energy sphere. But maybe there's some upside on these on this set of topics if Elon has his ear. That may be, you know, maybe part of the thought process. But he's talked about a lot of other things that I think, you know, in a personal way, I think there's a ton of us that agree with him, you know, and that's what's hard is if the Republican Party had a candidate that was, if you just rewound to John McCain, a guy who actually put forward a climate bill, which today the Republican Party would consider socialism. But at the time, it was a bill that he wrote with Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham, a cap and trade bill that was quite good. If you rewind to someone like that, a lot of folks would see some of the criticisms, I think, of some of the types of things that some Democrats, especially on the left, farther on the left, be. But today, what you actually see, Farzad, is a coming together of the far right and the far left on critical policies. You know, if you take a second to think about what's the difference between Donald Trump on trade and Bernie Sanders on trade, you'll be hard pressed to find a lot of differences. I mean, Trump and the steelworkers and other parts of labor are quite aligned. And that's a far cry from where I think we ought to be, which is generally speaking, a freer and more fair set of trade and tariff policies. That's kind of it's a sort of strange place to be where the Republican Party, under Trump, which I think could change over time, but under Trump is sort of more aligned with the far left than it is a centrist mindset on critical policies to advance, you know, advance our nation's economic security. So anyways, that's kind of my mindset here. I don't know that I have a great take on we've talked on X about, you know, my own personal disappointment on this, you know, the much talked about EV summit. I had a very similar set of disappointments when Trump didn't invite Elon to a set of discussions about the almost the same exact topic, 17, 18, 19, 20. We had lots of stuff there. Now, Elon actually maybe gave him the middle finger a little bit by leaving his committees. And he cited the Paris Agreement at the time as a reason why he left those Trump committees. So that was part of the dynamic. You know, they didn't necessarily trust us. They thought we were sort of the tree hugging green company. And so, but we got some good things done, even with the Trump administration, I have to say. But they, generally speaking, were looking to support Stellantis and GM and big utilities and oil and gas folks. So yeah, maybe that's part of his mindset. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Go ahead, Hans.
I have a spicy question. You can either take it or leave it. And it's only spicy in the sense that it seems like, well, it's politicized in really being the size of government question. And it seems like Trump is more, at least rhetoric right now, tends to be running more towards the let's compress the size of government, let's defang a lot of government agencies and get rid of a lot of regulation. And that aligns with the first part of our conversation on just the way that Elon wants to, you know, zero-base project thinking, zero-base solutions to a lot of problems. And Elon has talked about wanting to take a position as, you know, someone who would advise on government efficiency. Like, do you think that is a valid concern? And how does that play into our competitiveness long-term against a government like China that seems to be able to get more stuff done? Like, is part of our government's inability to compete with the Chinese government on getting stuff done bureaucratic and regulatory bloat versus, Yes. Incentive alignment.
Short answer is yes. Now the the slightly longer problem with that is that you, if you look at the actual facts and data from his term, he grew government by more, in fact, than Biden and far more than Obama. And not just this is not just the debt and deficit pieces of this. This is actually spending as well. So is it possible that he has had come to Jesus on the need for this and basically is going to do, you know, a complete remake of what he did for 4 years as president? Possible. That's certainly possible. But neither party has really done a great job. I mean, if you look at what he's actually said about what needs to be cut, basically his plan is I'm putting Elon in charge. But the reason why anyone says that is because, as Farzad has noted, you actually need to cut things that are very popular. So the real problem is on the Republican side, when you start talking about creating serious efficiencies around the military, oh my God, holy crap, you'll never be able to. If you start talking about creating efficiencies around the Medicare system, oh my God, you're taking away my Medicare. I hate socialism, but I love Medicare. So, but that's, and some of this stuff exists also on the Democratic side. Now, I think the Democrats get lost in the sauce on the discretionary pieces of government, even more so than Republicans, which is to say the non-discretionary side, the stuff like Social Security, Medicare, that stuff generally Democrats are pretty good on too, and have in the past, including Obama, have said we need to do something about this, put together commission, similar to what Trump is asking Elon to do. Basically commissions to say, how the hell do we cut the size of government, cut our spending on big ticket items. What I just mentioned gets in the way of actually doing the cutting, which is that the stuff that you have to cut is quite popular. You can create lots of efficiencies around lots of programs. If the point of this is to actually reduce the size and bureaucracy and problems in terms of permitting and all the other things that happen, that takes political capital and will. And you know, we know Donald Trump has been unwilling to note this, because if he did, he would lose the election in a landslide. So he's not saying, let's cut the military in a significant way. He's not saying, let's cut Medicare and Social Security in a significant way, or reduce benefits for certain types of people. Let's raise the age. Let's do lots of different things that could be done. No, he'll never say that. So not saying it means you're not running on it, which means the ability to actually get those things done in a real way is very difficult. Very, very difficult. Almost impossible. Republicans themselves won't vote for it.
Yeah, I was on public.com a couple of days ago, and they asked me that question. It's like, what are your thoughts on Elon sort of heading the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, right? Regardless, with Trump or Harris, like, let's say in a perfect world, there is a way for Elon to impact change, right? And make the government more efficient. The conclusion that I keep coming to is that the second there is one slightest bit of weakness in that execution, there will be screaming bloody murder from every single corner of the world, right?
Yeah.
Because it already happened. I mean, and the guest I was, the host I was speaking to, you know, he used X as a perfect example. He came in, he slashed 80% of the workforce, and it was very clunky for a few weeks, just like how, you know, I'm sure you've seen this a trillion times in Tesla. It's very clunky for a few days and weeks until you get it working, right? But it's a public and a private company, and you have people there that are willing to absorb the pain, right? Whereas in government, that, and this is where, like, I try not to get pessimistic, because the conclusion I always come to is like, this is going to be a bloated mess forever, because the execution against it feels too difficult. And it's
So there's two things at play. One is, do I think Elon could come up with, or someone like Elon, doesn't have to be necessarily Elon specifically, somebody with his kind of mindset could come up with some really good ideas? Yeah. In the government, just remember basic civics. Spending is done by Congress. So unless he has developed some really amazing relationships with lots of different congressional members across multiple spectrums and ideologies, you can come up with lots of different ideas. Congress mandates and sets spending limits and spending levels. That's who does that. So that's who appropriates money. That's who taxes the American people. So it's not the president who does that, and it's certainly not the executive branch that does that. Are there lots of things that the executive branch can do to create efficiencies? For sure. Project delivery, permitting, even in terms of requests of budget requests and warfighting especially.
What about like a culture change? Could it be like an impact where you're just setting a tone for Congress as the leader of the country? You're saying, guys, we have to make this happen. And I'm bringing this guy in and we're going to try to make it happen. It just like, is that too naive to think about?
No, I think it's right. It's the exact right thing. I mean, it's the exact right thing to do. And it's exactly what Kamala Harris should be doing as well. I mean, this is a necessary thing to do no matter who you are. And whether it's Trump now or in 4 years, it's some other Republican or Democrat. I mean, that is exactly right. But to your point, it's not done with a political mindset, because you can't, if you take the Twitter example, trying to do a crash and burn scenario and then build back up is possible at a Twitter to really build from the ground up and do it quickly without losing a lot of steam and problems. And, you know, we're all still using X very well, and it's done well for itself, it seems. I don't know what the hell the financial situation is there, but I'm sure they're doing well. So that's trying to take that type of mindset into any governmental policy whatsoever is a recipe for disaster. Because you're going to have, not only are you going to have the government workers themselves, you're going to have congressional members in certain districts that are impacted by that. You're going to have governors and other parts of the government that have a stake. You're going to have other supply chain entities and federal procurement entities that have a stake. You're going to have people directly impacted by some of those cuts that have a stake. So you have lots of different parts. Where this happens the best is in times of crisis, because getting big shit done outside of a crisis opportunity is really hard. So Rahm Emanuel used to talk about this, you know, the biggest possibility for big change and big investments and big government cutbacks and the like is not because somebody came and said this was important. It's during a time of crisis. So those opportunities are few and far between. That's where we need to strike when the iron's hot. And potentially, let's just say Trump wins and Elon puts together a set of recommendations, gets that cultural mindset in a different place. Potentially that has a positive impact. I think you're going to see something quite similar on the other side as well, though. It's not like the Kamala team is not talking about the very same kinds of issues in terms of efficiency, permitting. In fact, you know, just in the last couple of days, we've seen some pretty damn good bills advance in a Democratic Senate on permitting reform that, frankly, I don't think anybody was expecting. And Biden got behind two of them. So this is the kind of stuff that's happening. Is it happening to the extent that it needs to? More needs to be done.
Go ahead, Hans.
It's a question that really... I mean, maybe we can touch on it real quick. I was really excited because there was at one point in time when there was going to be some NEPA reform that was attached to one of the spending bills a couple years back, and then it just went away, never happened. Basically, I was just curious if you could comment on, if you know, what happened, why did it go away, and, you know, are there chances for us to get it back?
Quite bluntly, I don't think the Biden administration put enough into it. And I don't think the Republicans believed in it enough. So neither side was willing to make it a must part of the passage. And I think had Republicans been able to say this has to be in there, and if they had said this has to be in there, And if it is, we'll vote for the package. Then you might have seen also Biden say, oh, shit, okay, we could get bipartisan support for the IRA, as an example. Or in the bipartisan infrastructure law, if they could have gotten 50 more Republicans, and it could have been not even just a good bipartisan bill, but like an overwhelming bill. But in this case, it's kind of, these kinds of permitting reforms are so damn needed. I mean, and so I'm actually quite bullish on this. Now both parties are seeing this. The Democrats actually have a lot of need to do this, a very political need to do this, because they've invested in tons of projects through the IRA, through the bipartisan infrastructure law, that are getting hung up in some form. So they actually have a political reason now that maybe didn't exist as much, that they better damn well get in the game and start finding ways to be less bureaucratic, because their own projects that they have invested in are not going as fast as they should. Or some of the companies they've invested in even could go under because they can't get shit permitted. Basic processing facilities, mining facilities, battery materials, plants, chip factories. You know, this stuff needs to get built quickly, because otherwise capital's going elsewhere.
Yeah, I had a ton of respect for Joe Manchin for really, you know, putting his neck on the line to really try and get that across the finish line. And when it didn't happen, it seemed like that was the end of his political career. But it's cool to see that what he was fighting for, I think, potentially might come to pass anyways, that he was spot on in his leadership on that front.
This has annoyed me a lot about environmental groups, and I think I'm hopeful that this will change. It's this basic dynamic where they've been very good at fighting oil and gas projects and different types of coal plants and the like. But now that clean energy generally is cheaper and better, and clean transportation the same, when you have a winning formula and you can put it on steroids with faster and more efficient permitting, you'd be a moron to say, no, we still need to encumber all of these things, because you can win faster. You can win in a bigger way. Like it's an own goal of epic proportions right now. So I think more and more like-minded people are seeing this. And hell, if you want to speed up the permitting for some oil and gas facility, who cares? It's like, this is going to be a blip on the radar compared to the clean energy that's winning in a big way.
Yeah, the economics of the next generation they're too good to pass up. So even if you allow the old generation to come through, it's just uncompetitive, period.
Correct.
It's not going to compete. So you're letting capitalism do its thing. You're just
like
opening
Biden,
up the doors.
Biden got all sorts of shit for allowing this facility up in Alaska, the Willow facility. And that project, while important in the scheme of things, I mean, important from an emissions perspective, but in the scheme of things, when you include leakage, include all the other items there, you can put that up against the Inflation Reduction Act. And it's like, it's probably like 100 to 1, maybe more than that in terms of emissions reduction. So, but man, the environmental left got so pissed off at Biden for that project approval, when the reality was he was doing tons of other good things on things that are anyways winning.
Is there any chance that the work on that front will also impact the interconnect process approvals for all these, you know, battery storage plants and other, you know, other types of ways to quickly advance the grid?
Yeah, the interconnection queue is mind-numbing. This is one of those things where this is why I love Tesla and love the people so much. There's both a technology problem where you got some of these utilities and transmission operators and the like using like Excel files to study capacity in the grid. And also a problem in terms of the basic incentive structure around these intermittent renewables, where you got lots of projects coming into the queue, many of them which don't really make a lot of sense, but you sort of have to have, even if you only want to do one project, you kind of have to apply for five because you might only get one. And so that creates even more problems, because once a project gets kicked out of the queue or gets removed from the queue, then you have to kind of, you may have to even restudy the impact of all of the different projects in the interconnection queue. Now, Texas is faster than others on this front. Texas permitting on lots of things is not great. We found that out.
We are
up close and personal, in many different respects, but, Texas is way better on the interconnection queue than anybody else. So ERCOT is far better than PJM. It's far better than other, RTOs and RSOs. So they've figured out a way, to speed things up to a degree. More can be done with better technology, with faster timelines. And yeah, that's a huge piece of this. Some of this needs to be mandated just so that you can get the, needed speed. So, you know, if you said there's a maximum of a 2-year study or a maximum of a 1-year study with no ability to do further judicial review, things like that. So there's lots of different ideas in terms of transmission and the interconnection queue that really smart folks are moving on.
And do you think with the demand for electricity for things like data centers that we're going to have the political will to do that type of mandating?
This is where a little bit of sort of, let's say Chinese paranoia comes in and is useful. There's like every conversation I had this week with lots of different folks in this arena are, well, we got to do something here because of China. Okay. I mean, we should do it anyways, right? I don't understand why you're so worried about China in this regard. Like, but this is the kind of thought process that people have. And so I'm quite bullish on this notion, this general notion. Some of this will be done behind the meter, which also we also need to like really get in a better spot so that if someone is operating a data center and wants to do it fully behind the meter, meaning that it's not connected to the grid, or is only connected in a way to provide some value on the back end, but the generating resource is actually behind the meter, behind the electricity meter. That's something we should enable so that, you know, if a data center, if Google wants to say, or Tesla or anyone wants to say, yep, I'm going to put up a large scale solar facility, solar plus storage. I'm going to do geothermal, you know, stuff. I'm going to do fusion down the road. I'm going to, whatever the thing is. Great. Go for it. God bless. We're not going to put you through the craziness of the interconnection queue and the transmission problems that exist as a result. So that I think I'm quite bullish on. I would not worry too much about this. And I do have a general, worry about crypto and especially in the United States. I think currency, not to make this a crypto issue, but like there's a bunch of stuff about crypto that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The idea in some cases that it is that the energy use is basically the thing. It is the, way to unlock, value is deeply troubling to me. Because I think, you know, value to the economy, way more valuable to have a large scale data center up and running or tons and tons of electric trucks and, other types of electrification than some random crypto. But that's a different, yeah, that could be its whole podcast on its own.
Yeah. I know we're pushing up on time. We got 3 minutes left. Do you have time for one or two quick questions?
Yeah, I've got my brother's not here yet, so I got some time. My brother's coming down from Brooklyn with his two kids, and my kids are also very excited to hang out with them.
Oh man, that's gonna be a great time. Okay, yeah, perfect. I want to circle back a little bit to the conversation we were having around Elon and sort of his association to the Republican Party, supporting Trump, so on and so forth. One of the things that I keep hearing is that it's no secret to anybody that he's been very openly critical of the Democrat Party. He's been openly critical of Kamala Harris. He's been very supportive of Trump. And if Kamala Harris ends up winning the presidency, do you think this is going to be a hindrance for him in any way? Do you think that his criticism in the sort of arena is going to maybe not allow him to build the relationships that he needs? Or do you think this is just political rhetoric? We're getting close to an election. And then after, you know, the dust settles, people will shake hands and move forward. How do you view this impacting his relationship with his businesses in the States?
Well, here's my hope. My hope is if I were running for president and somebody was criticizing me in the way that he is criticizing Kamala and various other Democrats, you know, what ends up happening is it's less the candidate themselves and it's more all of the people around the candidate. When I worked for 10 years for Barack Obama, and it wasn't so much, it's ridiculous to even say this because she was even our Secretary of State for 4 years. But even to this day, I have trouble getting excited about Hillary Clinton because she was directly attacking my guy. That was my dude. And, you know, and so that's what happens in these kinds of scenarios where, like, I doubt Kamala Harris gives two shits, to be honest. I have no idea, but I doubt it. The people that do give a shit are the people maybe in her family, those on the campaign, supporters. So I would hope if I were the president, I would give the dude a call and say, and hopefully Elon would say, look, you know, no harm, no foul. Hope I can, you know, apologize for some of the things. Hope she might be able to apologize also for some of the thing. But, you know, people are human and they get pissed off about stuff and they hold grudges. So you know, it's hard to know exactly how that'll play out. I thought, quite frankly, that, you know, that Team Biden could have done more of this. Now, substantively, as you've seen, I've been kind of really a big supporter of many of the good policies that I thought they put forward. Didn't agree with everything, of course, but I was a big fan of how that impacted. And they brought us in on tons of stuff. I mean, virtually everything. You know, can you guys help us with this? Even asking Elon directly for some of that help. But the way that they decided to sort of deal with us in a public sense was just such a disappointment, frankly. So who knows? I mean, it could be wildly different with Kamala. It could be, you know, the thing that's so funny about this is that Trump was kind of an asshole to us, like a real asshole. I mean, not only in the policy sense, of course, mm-hmm. things that we actually supported, he tried to kill, but in the PR aspect as well. He would show up at, you know, on Twitter, or I can't remember if it was on Truth Social or Twitter, where he's like saying really demeaning stuff about Elon, actual lies. I was a part of that meeting. So I know, you know, I know it. I was in the Oval Office with them. I mean, he just lied about it, flat out lied. So, you know, it's like, it's kind of hard for me to process all of this. You know, I mean, if somebody lied about me in that way, I might not be so excited about them being president. But, you know, I think he's willing to look at the bigger picture in almost all respects. And I respect him for that as well, because he cares so deeply about these companies that he's built. He doesn't think of them as a company like we might. Like, he really believes in them as especially Tesla and SpaceX and maybe the others as well. Like children, you know, and so, you know, he is trying to look at a bigger picture. I have to give him credit for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, very candidly speaking, I remember, you know, I left Tesla in September of 21. I started making videos in November of 21. And I remember the next video I made was on the EV summit, you know, and we all know about the EV summit, right? And I remember I was just fresh coming out of Tesla, super proud of what the work I accomplished. You know, the content I was putting out there for about my time there was resonating with people. I'm like, yeah, I'm so proud. And then, you know, when I see the president of the United States sort of ignore the blood, sweat, and tears that I know how many people put in, like, I know the effort and the sacrifice that was, yep. that was put in to execute that stuff. And when I saw the president of the United States not only ignore that, but give the credit to a different party that objectively speaking was probably last on that list or near last on that list. That was a very hard, that is still to this day has left a very lasting pain, especially as somebody who identified as a Democrat, right? Has left a very lasting pain in my soul. It's like, bro, I was there, you know? And so it really speaks to that human side. You know, it speaks to that human side. It's like that for me is going to be very difficult to overcome, short of, like, the way I view it is, I think they're, you know, and I don't know why. I mean, I am taking it somewhat personally because I put in so much effort into that company, right? I put in, it's a part of me. It really is. As I'm sure it's a small part of you too. You know, that the effort that you put in there is like, it's very hard to step away from. It's almost like if I was an advisor to the Democrat Party, I would say, I think if they put in, like you said, a little bit of effort to put out in an olive branch, doesn't have to be in public, just an olive branch that says, hey, listen, let's let the past be the past. Let's move forward together. I'm not going to tell you to vote for us or whatever, but just letting you know that we're there. We really like what you're doing. Don't necessarily agree with everything you're saying, but we know that you're objectively good for America, right? And I think that is a message that is very, I think that's an objectively true statement. If Tesla and SpaceX didn't exist and Starlink, the United States, objectively speaking, would be in a worse place than it is now. Objectively, right? Just to kind of put it out there, I don't know if you resonate.
Not even a close call. It would be a much worse place. You know, I was with my kids and wife when I got the call that hey, next week we're doing this summit, and completely ruined the short spring break that we had. I mean, it was for you. You mentioned how you kind of feel about that time, and it was exact same. I mean, so and for me, maybe even more so at the time, because it's like, shit, isn't this the whole thing that you're supposed to be helping with? Why didn't you make this happen? Right. And nobody asked me that. Frankly, I'm grateful that nobody kind of put it on me. Like, what the hell? Why didn't you solve this? But yeah, it was deeply, deeply disappointing. It wasn't just one time either. I mean, that's the other thing. It was like, you know, then he was like feeding Mary Barra for things that made no sense. And the reasoning I got was, well, he's trying to credit her for supporting the greenhouse gas regulations, which she previously had cozied up to Trump under to actually reduce. You know, it's like, well, what? So she gets credit from Trump for helping to kill pollution regulations. She gets credit for Biden for creating an EV industry because she's supporting the improvement of these pollution regulations. I mean, she's all over the goddamn map on, like, what does she support? We don't know. Maybe whoever's president, she supports that thing. And yet she's getting credit for that. Like, that was, it was just wrong. It didn't make any sense. So, you know, even apart from being at Tesla, I think it was just disappointing to see a president like, what are you doing? So yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that piece of it. I think the bigger picture though is important to keep in mind. What did he actually do? What did he care about? What did he support? What policies were enabled? Long-term vision for what's necessary to build. And, you know, Trump talked about infrastructure a lot, got virtually nothing done. In fact, we had in terms of construction and infrastructure. He talked a lot about chips in China, and we had basically no chip manufacturing going on, or very little innovation in that space. Biden got some real shit done. Basically, Tesla was on an island on its own, doing its own thing. The only reason why the U.S. was in a decent position was because of Elon Musk and Tesla. And Biden comes in and says, you know what? We agree they're doing some good stuff. Let's try to get others to do the same thing. Let's do more of this. Let's get more of this going in the United States. Trump didn't do any of that. So I think substantively, that's why it's important. It's important to keep some perspective. Doesn't mean you can't still be pissed off and have beers and, you know, and say, what the hell is this guy thinking? Not even have beers. I'm drinking coffee.
Yeah. Shit. Like hardcore sober. Yeah. Do I have time for one more? I know we're over time.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And again, this is like, we're in a string of, like, you know, difficult topics to discuss, but it's, you know, you're been such a great sport. It's one of my favorite conversations to date. You know, one of the things that I hear a lot about, on, you know, cause I cover Tesla closely, EVs closely, the, Elon Musk and the sort of Trump relationship, you know, we know that Republicans have traditionally been anti-EV straight up. 100% agree with you. Some of the rhetoric that I was hearing from that side was completely bananas. All of it was false, right? Still to this day, there are things that Trump says about EVs that don't go far. What does that mean? You know, it's so frustrating. But, you know, nonetheless, there's something going on. You know, Elon thinks that he's the right guy for him and, you know, potentially his businesses as well. And I don't see why else he would, you know, latch on. But, you know, put that aside. One of the things I hear is like, hey, by doing that, you're alienating your core customer base who are traditionally Democrats, who are traditionally clean energy folks, right? And it's sullying the Tesla brand by Elon associating himself to this individual and to this party. How do you absorb that? I would love to hear your thoughts on that. Do you agree with that statement? If you agree with that statement, you know, I would love to hear your thoughts. But, and then Hans, I don't know if you want to add.
Yeah, and then maybe add into that, you know, is there any sort of corrosive effect internally? We talked about, you know, the Tesla team being made up of these true believers and that stomach for, you know, pain being part of what makes Tesla so effective. Does this have, you know, a negative impact also on people who are employees of Tesla and who are true believers on the climate front and their ability to really show up for the mission in the way that they were before?
Both of these are hard because I don't have any data one way or the other that's like particularly useful. I mean, I'll give you my own version of this, which is, it's not like Elon started saying provocative things on X/Twitter just this past year. I mean, it's not like he's been talking about, okay, Trump is an insanely controversial figure, right? And he's saying bizarre stuff every day. He could change his mind on abortion 5 different times today. And it wouldn't be that surprising. You know, I mean, the guy doesn't. So he's very controversial. And that's one thing, but Elon's been saying provocative stuff for a while. So, and I was definitely there and my team was definitely there and lots of people there. I mean, does anybody think that the 100+ thousand people that are working at Tesla all over the globe are, a bunch of Trump supporters? Because that's definitely not the case. I would guess, you know, it's 90%. Of the executive team will be voting for Kamala Harris. So, you know, it's like people, just as in politics is true and even more so in business. And you can separate things. I do see, I think all of us see in our own interactions, are there some people that you know that will not buy a Tesla as a result? Because of the Trump stuff or because of some other thing. No doubt. There are some people that are out there. Are there some people that are more willing to buy a Tesla as a result? No doubt. You know, I'm not super close with lots and lots of Trump people, but there are some people that I'm quite close with. And yeah, I think it actually does make them slightly. Barack Obama used to tell us this. I don't know that he ever said it publicly, but he used to say this all the time. There are some people, because he would get asked the question sometimes about like racism and, you know, we had like our offices broken into and, you know, nasty swastikas and dumb, really crazy Ku Klux Klan bullshit, some of which was public, some of which wasn't, all sorts of nasty stuff when he was running for president the first time over. And he would get asked the question, like, what do you think? How is this affecting you? You know, so there's a ton of people that will never vote for me because I'm black. And there's a ton of people that will only vote for me because I'm black. And I don't know exactly what that percentage is. It's impossible to poll people on this subject. Very, very hard. Is there a kind of canceling effect that's happening, one way and the other? Think so. Proof will be in the pudding. You know, you got to be able to sell the cars you make. Otherwise, you're going out of business real fast. Yeah. So can they sell the car at a good margin and sell the ones that they make and continue to invest in all the things they're investing in terms of autonomy, AI, robotics? It seems like they're able to thus far. And the proof will only be able to see that, you know, 10 years from now, were they able to succeed in terms of the mission and in terms of the work that they wanted to get done. So sorry, I'm not fully answering your question because I'm not even sure I really understand whether it's true or not.
Yeah.
And even in the sales data, like, it's very hard to disaggregate these things. You can do tons of focus groups and, you know, lots of people have polled this thing. And sometimes you'll see a poll that looks great on this. Sometimes you'll see a poll that looks terrible on this. Sometimes you'll see a customer sentiment or a customer sentiment that looks really good in terms of Tesla. And sometimes you'll see a poll. Somebody else will put something up on Twitter and it'll say the exact opposite. So this is where I get, you know, really skeptical of those that have hardened views as though they know whether or not this is serious shit that people inside of Tesla don't know. Like, you know, I mean, this is not like there's lots of people that are deathly worried about what this is doing to the, they don't know. They don't really know. Yeah. And so it might be helping, might be hurting. God only knows.
Yeah.
Go ahead. So what I hear is that you're really, really disappointed that Ross Gerber didn't get on the board.
God. Well, the guy that I actually would love to talk to at some point, you should bring him on. What's the analyst that sometimes, all of you guys make fun of?
Gordon Johnson?
Gordon, the Gordons. Oh man, that Gordon Johnson. There was nobody that used to annoy me more. There were a few reporters that used to annoy me more. But Gordon, holy That's shit. Difficult. What a doofus. Man, oh man.
He's a special one. I think, you know, let me throw my two cents here and then we can wrap it up. I think the way I've been trying to approach this, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because, you know, I know you, this is something, you know, it's part of your wheelhouse too, is like, I'm trying to be as objective as possible. I think for me, it's like, it's impossible to say that, like you said, that doesn't exist. That, you know, I know of a couple people that will not associate with the brand because of that individual.
Yeah.
But my thesis has been that it's immaterial, because it's like, how else do you have the best-selling car in the world being that brand? How else do you still grow the brand, even though your ASPs are still, you know, at the level that they're at? And then, you know, and I'm trying to go down the list of different variables, and it's just not adding up for me, you know?
Well, so I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'll give you an example of this. Okay. My parents are fairly moderate. My mom's super lefty now because of a sort of an anti-Trump strain, but my dad's quite a moderate guy, has voted for Republicans in the past. My wife is a lefty liberal. My cousins are Trump loving. They're all driving Teslas. And there's you only know what you know. What I know is that, yes, there are some people in my friends group and some people in my sphere that will never buy a Tesla. And there's some people that from now on will only buy a Tesla, even though they're of the same political stripe. So there's the product in the end, the product is the thing that actually fucking matters. Yep. You know, does the product work really well for you? Is it a good value for you? Cars are a little bit different in that, you know, it is a emotional purchase more so than almost anything else, even though it's such a large purchase for every household. It is more emotional, and there's more branding associated with it, and there's more things that go with it than purchases like that. But even still, it's very hard to know how this will play out. Be super skeptical of any poll that you see or any study that you see one way or the other, trying to reinforce your own view that this is actually not a bad thing, or trying to reinforce your view that it is a bad thing. Either way, I would be extremely skeptical of either side of this argument. And the only thing that will matter is, can you maintain really healthy margins, and can you maintain the ability to sell the products that you're making and innovate fast enough so that people are excited about the new products?
Yeah. Value per dollar. If you can offer something that people, when they compare, cross shop anything, right? If that's clearly a better purchase, that should take care of itself in the long term.
Yeah.
As long as you can make enough of them, right? Rohan, this was incredible, bro. You're welcome anytime. I feel like your wealth of knowledge, experience, background, I love your passion for the company. You know, we've met a couple times in person, just such a easy guy to talk to, super candid and forthcoming. Thank you so much, dude. I really appreciate your time. Like I said, welcome back anytime. We'll be very greedy with your time. So I hope, you know, definitely keep that in mind when you agree. But if you agree, and then I don't know, Hans, if you want to throw in something before we get.
Yeah, and also just huge appreciation for the contribution that you and your team have made to Tesla, to Tesla's mission. And yeah, it's like interfacing between an incredibly innovative company and something that is so incredibly bureaucratic as the government. Like, that seems like a very, very hard job that not many people want to sign up for and do, but it is incredibly important. And so, yeah, really, really appreciate your willingness to glass and stare into the abyss of that job role.
Honestly, it didn't feel like eating glass. I mean, maybe at the time a little bit sometimes, but I was so damn lucky, man. So incredibly lucky to have some of the experiences I did and to have the team I did. Holy shit. What a team. Everybody that hires people and is good at this knows you try to hire people that are more talented than you are and smarter than you are. And I had that, a million times over and was just lucky to get the opportunity, to be honest. And so, yeah, I feel very, very, very privileged to have had the chance and to have learned a lot, and had some really, really great times. So yeah, I'll be rooting for the company, rooting for you guys. You guys do a really cool thing out here, and yeah, I'll keep being a listener, being a fan.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. Where can people find you on socials, Rohan?
On social?
Yeah, where can people find
you? I shouldn't be on X as much as I am. God, they should not be finding me on there, but I guess I'm on X. That's really the only platform. I have a Facebook account that I've deleted a couple times, but then my high school friends or somebody were like, dude, can you get back on for what? And so, but I really don't use anything else. LinkedIn, you know, I guess everybody kind of is on LinkedIn at this point, but I don't know how much we actually use it for anything, but every once in a while I'll go check on LinkedIn. So yeah, but I'm on X and probably too much on X, and I'm pretty responsive on X, probably more so than I should be, as I said.
Yeah. That's a boy, do I fall in that trap often. It's like, it's just a magnet. It's a magnet for trouble. And I'm like, oh boy, why did I do that? And I'm like, well, maybe I shouldn't delete that because it's already out there, you know. Anyway, it's a whole thing, yeah. You know. But anyway, thank you so much, Rohan. Really appreciate you once again.
And you got it.
Go ahead and let me end recording here. And.